On Tech News Today, Google rolls out a new Pixel that's better, faster, and cheaper. The Guardian backs off on their Whisper campaign, and we're going to give you a break from Apple News today. You're welcome. We've got great journalists today from Quartz, Mashable, The Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, and Reuters. So stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, March 12th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 50-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And by LegalZoom. It's National Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom, and the best time to create the business you've always dreamed of. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and joining us as co-anchor today is Quartz Senior Silicon Valley Correspondent Alice Truong. Welcome to you, Alice.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we've had you on as an interview guest several times, but this is the first time you've been on as a co-anchor, I believe. But I welcome you to the show, and we're going to have a lot of fun. As I was saying before the show started, we're meerkatting this. So if you're watching the show and you want to get in on a delayed, low-resolution version that doesn't show most of the show, then just go to Twitter and follow, you know, find my Twitter account, Mike Elgin, and click on my most recent post. But anyway, Alice, I welcome you to the show, and why don't we jump right into the news?
Sure.
As we were concluding the show yesterday, Google announced its Chromebook Pixel 2, the highest-end version of its cloud-based Chromium OS laptop. Mashable Tech editor Pete Paschal is here to tell us about the new Pixel. What's going on, Pete?
Hey, Mike. Now, it's going well. I got one of the Pixels.
Great. Right, I knew I could count on you to be waving the goods around. You always do that. Every time I have you on, you got watches on your wrist or whatever we're talking about. So what's different in the new Chromebook Pixel?
You know, it's very similar to the first one. It's got a spec bump. You know, it's basically got the most current processor, a Broadwell Intel Core i5. It's got the same resolution because the first one was already kind of a Retina level display, but it did beef up the color this time. It has 32 gigs of storage, and it's got a few, it's about 3.3 pounds. So it's not like an ultra portable. It's not super heavy, but they didn't prioritize it being thin and light. It's very similar to the design of the last one. So it's all very similar. Everything just gets a bump up. The battery life gets an improvement to 12 hours. So that's actually a significant improvement because it's been a couple of generations of chips since then. And, you know, it's got a 720p webcam. But one of the biggest things that it's notable for are these right here. This USB Type-C port, which, of course, is also the only port you'll find on the MacBook, the new MacBook, which Apple unveiled a couple days ago. The new Chromebook and the MacBook are two of the first PCs, two of the first laptops to have the new connector. And this is supposedly, once again, the one connector to rule them all in our brave future, which does data, obviously, transfers. It'll also extend to an external display. And it also provides power. It does all those things. Now, the Chromebook is notable for actually having two, one on this side, one on the other. So you can pretty easily charge and extend to another display at the same time. Also, those aren't the only ports. That's another way it's different from the MacBook. You actually have two regular size USB as well. And of course, you probably saw the SD card over there. Sorry, SD and headphone jack right there. No, wait, the headphone jack's over here. It's somewhere. There it is. So, you know, it's got a lot more ports, but the USB-C is the really big deal because not only does it provide power, provide power pretty quickly, it charges fast. It gets something like 2 hours of use from a 15-minute charge. I believe that's the spec. So it's a modern laptop. It's definitely trying to point the way for new all laptops to come, particularly through the use of that port.
So this week we saw two really flashy debuts of computers with this new connector. I'm curious, when do you think that this might become, like, how long will it take for it to come to an industry standard?
Pretty quick. I think by this time next year, you're going to be seeing it on pretty much everything. I mean, the chips support it, so that's not hard. It's just a matter of putting it in. And I can't really, you know, there's not really a good reason not to. The only, you may still see some independent charging ports from the USB-C. Some models may do that simply because I believe the Type-C wattage isn't quite as high as you might be able to get on some other models if you just went with something else. But in terms of connectivity, I don't think there's much reason not to include it. It does pretty much everything. It lets you reduce the size of these things. And as once more and more drives, connectors start supporting it, I think it's just going to take over because it just makes a great deal of sense. And one of the best things about it, and I've got the other side here, the male side, I mean, it's reversible. So just like Apple's Lightning, the frustration of putting a USB connector in wrong will soon be a thing of the past, and that'll be the most practical benefit I think most people will get out of it.
Now, the original Pixel was slammed by critics for having the unfortunate combination of limited usage in terms of the fact, you know, because it's a cloud-based system, was considered something far less than a real laptop and a very high price. I believe it was $1,299 or something like that. And so this price has come down under $1,000 to $999 for the starting point. Is that the sweet spot, in your opinion? Do you think that the fact that it's a three-digit price for the starting model, will that turn heads and make people really consider this in a way that they didn't for the first one?
I don't think that many people on the price alone. I think once you price yourself above $500, $600, you're completely losing the entry-level crowd. And a lot of people are just going to be like, well, it's still just Chrome. Here's the thing. And this is why I like the Pixel, actually. I gave it a good review. Though I understand the criticisms, and it's really looking at it from a different point of view. Like, I tested this thing, you know, I kind of dog fooded it. I basically decided, okay, I'm going to do my job on this machine and see how much of it I can do. And shockingly, I was prepared to like slam it for not being able to do much. 95% of what I do is in the cloud. You know, now most of my day, again, 95% of my day, I'm connected. So this thing actually performed extremely well, and because of its native connection to Chrome and Google services, it gives you the best possible performance for that 95%, because most of my job is in the web. And it's with a Core i5 processor backed by a OS that is backed by Chrome. I mean, it's the best browser experience I've ever had. And since I spend so much time in the browser, that's really good. Now, that said, there are a few apps and experiences it can't do. For example, if you're in the Apple environment and you're using their apps, so whether it's FaceTime, reminders, etc. I mean, you're kind of siloed there, and there aren't a lot of there are workarounds and substitutes, but you can't really get those per se conveniently anyway. So, you know, there's a few thing compromises you have to make, but for what I think a lot of people do most of the day, it's very, very good.
One thing that, you know, strikes me particularly interesting about this new machine is that the Pixel has both, you know, as you mentioned, the USB Type-C connector as well as two USB ports. And I'm curious, do you think that will help with its adoption? And was that a limiting factor of the new MacBook?
Yeah, well, that's the great thing about this one is you don't need that dongle on top of things for a great deal of stuff. Although, they, you know, there's certainly a lot of dongles that Google has. And, you know, I don't think it's – not sure what it's charging for them, but you will need at least one if you're extending to a display, because you'll need to go to either an HDMI or DisplayPort connector. But I think that's a plus, because I was able to take the Pixel and basically put it right into my my workstation, which has a USB hub and an external display. And with virtually none, I mean, I did have to have the one dongle to HDMI, but that was it. So I think that's going to help. I also think by having two, it actually has quite an edge over the MacBook, because then when you're, like I say, doing the power and display at the same time, without any dongle, or at least without any adapter, is a plus. It also helps that, you know, often you find that your power port is on the inconvenient side of your laptop in some situations. And in this case, it's always on the convenient side. So that's nice.
Pete, I've noticed when I use the first Pixel that, you know, the same phenomenon you experience with this one and the same phenomenon that most users experience, which is that, wait a minute, I am mostly in the cloud already. This is not a big limitation. And I think that it has to be said that the main thing that the Pixel can't do is run malware. And that is a killer feature, in my opinion. And so I think if people are skeptical and wondering whether they can really do their work, you should give it a try. At least try a Chromebook, a cheaper one. They're practically giving them away on Amazon.com. But and if you realize you can do your work, then move up to the Pixel. It's a really awesome computer. The first one was great. This one sounds even better. So I'm really excited about this, and I may actually get one. Although the new MacBook looks pretty awesome as well. Pete Paschal is at Mashable.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Pete Paschal. Thanks you so much for joining us today, Pete.
My pleasure.
Let us know what you think about the Pixel 2 and the Chromebook phenomenon in general by sending email to tnt@twit.tv. We want to hear your opinion about computing in the cloud through Google's universe. Well, in just a sec, we got a lot more news for you. But first, let's talk about ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is the best way to hire people because they will enable you to post to 50-plus job boards with a single click. And not just job boards, social networks as well. Social networks like Facebook, Google Plus, and Twitter. You can find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once, and then the qualified candidates just roll in. They have something called Premium Traffic Boost, which can get you up to 3 times more candidates. It's like an insane mode for your job search. You can get premium job promotion for 30 days as part of this traffic boost, featured listing in their daily job alerts, which goes to 10 million job seekers, and up to 100 additional visits to your job posting. It's really fantastic. And one of the great things about ZipRecruiter, of course, is that hiring is usually a group effort among your team. It's not just one person doing all the hiring. And when you're using ZipRecruiter, it doesn't matter if there's 1 or 100 people involved in the job search, it's the same price. You can quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right person fast. And that's why ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 200,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com, and the most important part is /TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Well, the Chinese e-commerce company Alibaba is investing globally in a wide variety of technology areas. The company announced yesterday that they're working with 2 British lending startups to offer financing for companies in the UK that want to buy from suppliers selling, you guessed it, on Alibaba. The company is also in the news today for making a $200 million investment in Snapchat and also investing in the connected car industry. But for this segment, we're focusing in on the partnerships in the UK. Lisa Fleischer is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and she joins us now. Welcome to you, Lisa.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great. As I said on Twitter, it was great to see you at Mobile World Congress. I didn't get a chance to talk to you because both of us were doing our jobs at the time every time I ran into you. But anyway, welcome to the show. Now, can you tell us a bit more about what Alibaba is doing in the UK here?
Sure. So what Alibaba is doing is essentially providing a way for UK businesses that want to buy from Chinese suppliers, providing a way for them to have financing. So like, for example, if you're a business and you want to buy $50,000 worth of parts or t-shirts or, you know, whatever it is that you might want to buy and either resell or combine and make it to something else, you can find your supplier on Alibaba.com and you'll be able to basically just pay them straight away through that. There are 2 UK startups that are providing the lines of credit. It comes about a month after Alibaba announced a similar deal with Lending Club in the States. So American companies can also get credit on Alibaba for purchasing on their site. So, I mean, we've seen similar deals like this with eBay and with other types of companies where they'll, like, for example, if you want to buy a car on eBay, you can, like, I guess, get financing through a lender there. If you want to purchase from stores, for example, you can get credit through those stores. But the interesting part of this deal, I think, is that Alibaba basically went with two local UK startups that were offering businesses finance. So like they know the market, they're able to assess credit, they sort of have a bit of a track record here, you know, only a couple of years, but still it's not, it's an easier way for the companies to, or sorry, it's an easier way for Alibaba to try to assess the creditworthiness of the local UK small businesses.
So how does this compare with the Lending Club partnership that you mentioned? And I'm wondering if either one of them is particularly more advantageous for Alibaba.
You know, I'm not sure if it really makes a difference for Alibaba. The on its face, the only real difference that I can see is that the Lending Club partnership is sort of peer-to-peer, what they call peer-to-peer. So, you know, they'll have other people kind of come in, whereas the UK two different startups are direct lenders. And, you know, whether that actually makes a difference to the small business that's making the purchases, I don't know. I don't think so. You know, I think, you know, you might get different terms based on which lender you go with. But then again, I think in this environment where small businesses are finding it difficult to find credit or financing anywhere, oftentimes if they can just get a loan with, you know, I think the general annual interest rates might be between 15 and 30% for things like credit cards or even on revolving lines of credit for these small businesses. So, you know, while... you know, it's not like getting a mortgage for your house, which is are much lower rates, but the rates for financing some of these purchases are more akin to what we would think of as credit card purchases.
Now, Alibaba is all over the news today, and they're really a rising sort of company, rapidly rising. They were founded in 1999 by Jack Ma, who I think is one of the richest, if not the richest person in China. He's something of a rock star there. And, you know, I think that for American and European and others outside of China, the Alibaba brand, if you will, is not super familiar, but they are just a gigantic and fast-growing company. Can you briefly summarize for us, Lisa, what this company is, just sort of the 10,000-foot view, and what kind of a phenomenon they are in China?
Sure. I mean, I had to myself really kind of bone up on Alibaba just before writing this story, because it's not a company that I encounter on a daily basis. You know, if you were talking to me and I was halfway across the world in China, it would be a much different story. So what Alibaba started out in 1999 was a way for people to find suppliers online. And, you know, it kind of grew by being able to verify or give some sort of authenticity or you know, kind of putting its weight behind some of those suppliers that it found. So people who wanted to, you know, buy from supplier X in whatever town could maybe be a little bit more confident in them because they were on Alibaba or because Alibaba was checking on them. And it grew from there. It grew into more of a multi-pronged business. It has an Amazon-style store. It does has a payment system. It has a bank type function. So it's really kind of touched a lot of different parts of your life. I mean, we did a whole project kind of just trying to map out and explain Alibaba to Westerners. So there's like a video that kind of explains that on WSJ.com.
All right. Well, you can catch up with Lisa Fleischer at WSJ.com and also on Twitter at Lisa Fleischer. Thank you for joining us today, Lisa.
Thanks so much, guys.
All right. We told you back in October about a Guardian report that slammed the anonymous messaging app Whisper for tracking users, harvesting their personal data, and sharing it with the Pentagon, among other things. At the time, Whisper slammed the report, saying it doesn't follow or track users and accused the Guardian of publishing, quote, lousy falsehoods, unquote. Whisper did change their privacy policy statement as a result, however, and now it looks like The Guardian is actually backing off their report to some extent. Anthony Ha is a writer at TechCrunch, and he joins us now. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, can you tell us about The Guardian's clarification?
Yeah, first of all, it's this kind of giant block of text that's kind of hard to parse. And there's like a lot of, it's like very kind of nuanced language. But the gist of it, I think, is so that the core of what, as you said, what the Guardian had been reporting was that Whisper was tracking users, and I think particularly sort of alarmingly tracking users after they'd, you know, opted out of location services. And what the clarification says, which is what Whisper had been saying, was that the only way it was really tracking people once they've opted out was by their IP address, which you know, is not very detailed. It's very, you know, like city level information. So it seemed like the crux of what the Guardian had sort of been making a big deal about turned out, I think, not to be nearly as alarming as they made it sound.
So the Guardian also mentioned at the end of this long block of text that it was pulling an opinion piece as well. So does this all mean that, you know, just jump the gun on the story?
I think so. I mean, my sense of it, and again, you know, the other thing about it is that the language that they use is there's no real explanation of exactly what happened here. So this is, you know, speculative to a certain extent. But my perception was that a lot of it, and why they were able to, they framed this as a clarification, not a correction, is that I think a lot of what they got wrong was more context of like, yes, there are ways in which Whisper was like sort of tracking or like had information, but it's the kind of information that any mobile app would have. And so I think really where they kind of, it seems like they got it wrong was trying to make things sound alarming that, you know, are, you know, standard practice.
Anthony, what was Whisper's response to the Guardian's clarification?
They basically just said, you know, well, I think they had this sort of emailed statement, which was just, you know, for us, this isn't about vindication, which I think when you say that, that means it's a little bit about vindication. And they just said, you know, I think they're trying to emphasize that, yeah, look, we've been saying that we respect your privacy, and see, we totally respect your privacy.
And what about the timing of the terms of service? The clarification notes that, you know, Whisper had been drafting this apparently simultaneously right before the actual story. Is there anything else of note from there?
No, I think, I mean, so it does seem like, I think the way the Guardian had framed it originally was, yeah, the reporting came out and the terms of service changed sort of around the same time. So it was sort of easy to kind of make, you know, connect the dots and say, oh, obviously they changed the terms of service because they knew they were about to get called out on it. But it seems that, you know, the Guardian has been provided information that made them feel like they had to say, oh, actually, we did actually get that wrong. And this was in the works for a while, you know, was in the works for a while.
Anthony Ha writes furiously at TechCrunch.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Anthony Ha. Thank you so much for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you.
All right. Well, the Moscow-based cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab has risen to prominence as a top expert on U.S. espionage, but they hesitate to go after Russian spying out of fear, according to a new report by Reuters' Joseph Men. Joseph joins us now to explain all this. Welcome to you, Joseph.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Now, why doesn't Kaspersky expose – this is hard to say. Why doesn't Kaspersky expose Russian spy campaigns as much as they do U.S.?
Right. So, well, that's an interesting question, and I don't think we have definitive answers, but I spoke to – quite a number of people inside Kaspersky and who were formerly at Kaspersky, and basically they're nervous. They have a number of connections with the FSB, with the MVD, and with the rest of the power structure in Russia. And it's a big deal to blow the whistle on an ongoing military or intelligence operation. Nonetheless, they should get points for the times they have done it. So I reported that they were about 5 months after BAE, a big UK defense contractor, in reporting on a campaign that was heavy in Ukraine that was had to do with the Russian intelligence gathering. But they did put out something. What's interesting is that Mandiant and CrowdStrike in the U.S., which have gotten a lot of headlines, seem almost entirely to talk about China and Russia and never about the U.S.
Now, is the firm divided internally on this matter, whether or not to expose such spy campaigns?
You mean Kaspersky?
Yes.
So there are always, on any given report, any of the big ones, it appears that there are people on both sides. There are some people who say this is going to be a really bad idea, and there are others that say, you know what, either it's going to come out anyway, or it's going to we're not going to be credible on other things we expose, unless we occasionally point the finger at our own guys. So. There is often a debate, and that's one of the things I reported.
Now, isn't Kaspersky associated with the KGB?
So Eugene Kaspersky, the chief executive and one of the founders, did go to a KGB school for cryptography and other technical things. The chief operating officer of the company was in the military and rose to lieutenant colonel. That's on Kaspersky's website. They say almost nothing in public about their chief legal officer, who was also briefly in the KGB. He was in the border troops, which Karin Kaspersky is sort of like working in customs. They say it's not that big a deal. But he does talk about having worked for the KGB.
Joseph Menn is at Reuters.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Joseph Menn with two N's on the end. Thank you so much for joining us, Joseph.
Thanks for having me.
All right. The BBC is giving away 1 million Raspberry Pi-like mini computers to 11-year-olds across the UK as part of an initiative to get kids more interested in technology. Sounds like a great idea. The computers are called microbits, and they can be used to build simple computers, robots, or other devices. They'll be given to students in the secondary school in the autumn term, and the program is part of the Make It Digital initiative, and it involves 50 partners, which include Microsoft and Google, lots of other companies, lots of nonprofit organizations, a big effort there. And I think this is really great, Alice, because, you know, one of the problems with technology these days and kids growing up with technology is they're, you know, they're kind of introduced to technology as appliances. You know, a kid playing with an iPhone is learning literally nothing about technology. And, you know, in the old days, you know, in the, I guess, the 70s and 80s, to use a computer was really to program it. And as computers got easier to use, they challenged you less. And nowadays, you got to watch shows like Padres Know How, coming up after TWIT, to learn how to do technology stuff, tinkering, building things, and, you know, really doing things on your own. And younger kids don't have the opportunity to learn that stuff. So this is, I think, a great thing. But what did struck you about this story, Alice? I mean, it's really kind of, you know, personally, I'd like to see a lot more of it. What did you think?
I think that it's fascinating, right? It's remarkable the projects that people have been able to come up with Raspberry Pi, which is something I'm much more familiar with than the microbit. But at the same time, I must say, as somebody who does own a couple of Raspberry Pis, there is a lot more than, you know, just opening a box and just getting going. There's a lot that goes into it. So, you know, I'm particularly curious about the training side of things and the education, how to get kids to actually start fiddling around. It's not easy to pick up C++ or Python.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. My son actually works for a startup called Tinker, which teaches kids programming. And he's kind of amazed at how quickly kids pick up kind of obscure programming concepts when they think that they're playing and goofing around. I mean, they think they're building stories and just having fun. And I think that's one of the great things about stuff like this. If you can just kind of turn kids loose with this stuff and let them experiment and follow their own curiosity, I think they'll get a lot further, a lot faster than what normally passes for computer education now, which is where you have a bank of computers in some room and the teacher's telling them to type something or, you know, go to some website and click around. They're not really learning anything. So I think it's really cool. And I'm really curious to see what happens. I mean, you know, I'm sure some kids won't be interested. You know, every personality is different. And other kids are going to build giant robots. You know, we're going to see giant robots coming out of Leeds, like attacking other cities and stuff like that. I hope, at least. It'll be great for the upcoming movie anyway. Well, we told you yesterday about the curious disappearance of one Paul Seglia, who was accused of defrauding Facebook by claiming ownership of half the company and using fake documents to prove it. With a looming court appearance, he vanished from his home while leaving his court-mandated electronic ankle bracelet behind. The question is, how did he fool the system? Those ankle bracelets have motion detectors, and if they remain still for too long, an alarm is sounded. Well, today we found out. We're learning that Seglia appears to have built a handmade contraption involving a stick connected to a motor that would keep the bracelet moving. I think he learned it on Know How. Right, Padre? And Seglia is facing 40 years in the slammer if they can find him and if they can convict him. But, you know, you got to give him credit, Alice, for ingenuity, at least.
Yeah, certainly. I think I read that the motor was fixed to the ceiling as well. It seems really like an episode out of White Collar.
And he could probably have used microbits as well if he was in the UK and if he was 11 years old. So very cool. Well, we've got some product updates for you. Twitter has updated its terms of service to explicitly ban revenge porn, which they're defining as any sexually explicit videos or images posted without consent. Victims can report violations to Twitter, and Twitter claims that they'll remove those images. The move follows a similar policy change by Reddit, which happened, I think, a few weeks ago. Alice, this is clearly a good thing. Twitter wanted to be the free free-flowing, freedom of information, freedom of speech site. But little by little, they're realizing that that doesn't really work very well.
Yeah, abuse has been a really big concern from a lot of users who have tried at certain moments to derail, you know, Twitter's earnings live tweets to talk about abuse. So it's really interesting to see it finally moving in this direction to respond to all of these claims of harassment and bullying. What I found really, really interesting is I think that Kashmir Hill at Fusion had probably the best take on this, which is the quote-unquote Wiener exception. So if a newsworthy figure like Anthony Wiener tweets a photo of himself that goes viral, is that something that they would remove? And the answer is newsworthiness is an exception.
Wow, that's amazing. The Wiener exception, huh? Kashmir Hill, she's awesome. She's been a guest on the show many times, and that is an interesting a fact, but I guess that falls into, line with a lot of practices that are out there. There are exceptions made in all kinds of areas for newsworthiness. You know, you have to balance the right of privacy with the public's right to know. So that is actually an interesting idea. Well, Google has now extended Street View to the area around Mount Everest. It's called the Khumbu region in Nepal, and it's in Street View, but of course, most of the views are trails, rope bridges, and as we're looking at the video version now, yak parking lots and other local points of interest. The pictures were taken with the help from the Apa Sherpa Foundation and the Nepalese nonprofit Story Cycle on a 10-day expedition. And the Apa Sherpa, by the way, was a real Sherpa, and this dude is legendary for climbing Mount Everest, I don't know, dozens of times. He's a beast. Of climbing, just absolutely amazing. But how awesome of that! What a world, Alice, to have Street View photos and of course Jason had a comment this morning when we were putting the show together. What did you notice on this Street View thing?
What I noticed, Mike, was really cool. Is I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Street View on the phone. You can obviously look around. It has a really cool feature where you can activate in this corner right here. Where it spins around, so it's based on where the phone is pointing. So as if you're actually there. But what's really cool is with Cardboard also installed on an Android device, you can double tap that, and it sets it up for a virtual reality situation. Oh, let me get the glare out of there. So now you can put these in a pair of Cardboard or like a Samsung Gear VR if you bypass the micro USB plug, and you can look around as if you're there. It puts you in a virtual reality kind of. You know, climbing Mount Everest. Turn up the air conditioning and you'll believe you're there.
That is amazing. Alice, any comments on this? I mean, this is just, Jason was showing me his Samsung Gear VR yesterday, and one of the scenes was actually it might have been Mongolia or somewhere, but it was you're in a yurt and looking around and people are having lunch and stuff like that. This is amazing technology. Anyway, where do you think this is going? I mean, they keep improving Street View like this, and now it's in virtual reality. Where do you think Street View is going to be in 5 or 10 years?
Oh, man, you're really putting me on the spot because I have no idea. Street View continues to blow my mind. This is, climbing Mount Everest is probably one thing that I'm never going to do in my lifetime. And it's remarkable to think that, one, I can see the photos, but two, I can experience it with a piece of lo-fi hardware connected to a smartphone. But I have no idea where it's going to go. How much more immersive is it going to get?
Well, one of the things that has to be, as we get, the virtual reality and augmented reality products keep emerging, it's important when we're thinking about these technologies to realize that there are two fundamental versions of virtual reality. One of them is the kind of cardboard-centric, the Street View thing. What it is there are photographs that are taken in all directions, and you can look around in a still photograph. The other extreme version is when you have a virtual creation. It's not photographed real life. You have things that are created in three dimensions in software. It's flowing and moving. You can have objects and creatures and monsters, whatever, moving around in real time. You can navigate through that space. And then there's another variant, which is where at some point in the future, people will climb Mount Everest in real time with special 360 cameras, and you'll be able to see video and you'll be there and they'll climb Mount Everest so you don't have to, that kind of thing. But you'll be there and you'll see real time video. And of course, certain companies are already come out with the cameras for those types of experiences. I think Samsung is one of them. And it's just going to be incredible to be able to do, to experience other places as if you're there with the sights and the sounds, and who knows, with smell-o-vision, maybe even the smells of some remote, far-off place at an altitude that nobody wants to go that high, you know? I mean, it's like, it's, oh, here we go. Here's a virtual reality something. What are we looking at here, Jason?
Galaxy 11. It's a football
game. Galaxy 11. Oh, those are football players? I thought they were like, huh. Anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, it's just fascinating all around, the street view, the 3D, the VR, all of it. Well, in news you can lose, Vio. Remember Vio? They have launched a smartphone. If you recall, Vio used to be a Sony laptop brand, but then Sony sold its PC business to the investment firm Japan Industrial Partners in February of 2014. Now they're coming out with a smartphone on March 20th. But here's the weird part. The Vio smartphone looks exactly like Panasonic's Iluga U2, which is for sale in Taiwan. The specs are identical, too, according to the Japanese site Blog of Mobile. I don't have all the facts yet, Alice, but this appears to me to be this company that bought Vio is just trying to exploit the Vio brand, the brand recognition of Vio, to sell just some phone that they bought. I don't think they even built this phone. But what are your thoughts on this?
I'm not even sure how successful it's going to be. I was looking at some of these early reviews, early hands-ons, and everybody just sort of thinks, you know, it's an okay phone, but there's nothing particularly remarkable about any of these particular features, like the camera, for instance, or any of the any other like crazy sort of tech that these companies are now cramming into their smartphones. So, you know, they probably are cashing in on the brand, but they need to have something to show for it. At least that's what I've gathered.
All right, well, we got a wrap-up coming up right after we tell you about LegalZoom. LegalZoom is one of our sponsors today, and they are a fantastic service because they will save you a bundle on legal services. Lawyers are expensive. Everybody knows that. But oftentimes, if you're doing something like starting a business, you don't need a lawyer for everything, and you may not need a lawyer for anything if you're starting a small business. And, of course, you know, things like taxes are more complicated when you're a small business. And if you're new to it, you may not be aware of how to go about it. And of course, LegalZoom will help you with taxes, licenses, permits. They'll help you with your federal tax ID, your state tax ID, your applications, your business licenses, your seller's permit, all of the things that you have to do to run a legal business and do it right. They'll help you with corporate supplies, certificates of good standing. There are lots of things when you launch a business that you may not have thought of when you first set out. I mean, you probably know that you should have a business legal plan. They have documents to help you with that. If you're going to have a website, you should have website terms and conditions. You know, do you know how to do that? It's actually, it's something of an art form, and LegalZoom will help you with that art, help you be a terms and conditions artist. They're also offering attorney consultations for only $50. They're not a law firm, but they built a network of trusted attorneys to provide the guidance you need for your specific situation. And, of course, they've helped a million business owners. Go to LegalZoom.com today. Go to LegalZoom.com right now to find out more. Attorney consultations are provided by independent attorneys available in most states. Get the legal help you need for your business at LegalZoom.com. And make sure you enter offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. That's LegalZoom.com. Use promo code TNT. Remember that legal help is here. Our TNT fan of the day is Don LeCay, who posted this picture. You ready for this, folks? Better sit down. This is going to be spectacular. This picture of himself watching TNT on his phone in front of the biggest pyramid at Chichen Itza in Mexico. Can you click on that picture and let's see the whole thing? Boom. Like a boss. Check it out. I've been there. That is an amazing pyramid. I love that structure. It is just stunning. And, of course, he's too busy watching TNT to see it. So he didn't even see the pyramid. Too busy watching the show. And he did it just to prove that he could and just to say that he can do it. Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. You don't have to be in front of a grand pyramid in Mexico or even Egypt. However you watch TNT, we'd love to see it. Just take your picture or the video, post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and make sure you use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. Alice Truong,
thank you so much for co-anchor today. Great job. You are at QZ.com and you're on Twitter at Alice Tarong. What are you working on these days? And where do you recommend, besides where I mentioned, that people can follow your work?
I went to a pot investor conference earlier this year, and I've been mulling on other trends in the pot tech industry.
Marijuana beat. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's one of the things that I do cover. So a couple of trends, you know, investing is taking a very different route. And the other thing that's really fascinating to me is that organic marijuana is a thing. And of course, wow. In the Bay Area, it's something that people would demand.
It's a good idea because, I mean, it's like, you know, it's something, it's like a food or anything else. It's going in your body, so you don't want pesticides. So that sounds really amazing. And I'll look forward to reading that at QZ.com. Thank you so much for co-anchoring today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on YouTube. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv. or on the app or browser plugin of your choice, which you can find at twit.tv/apps. If you're ever in Sonoma County wine tasting, come on in and taste some tech. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV and come hang out with us in our Google Plus community. Just search Google Plus for Tech News Today and you'll find it. You can also follow me on Meerkat. I've been meerkatting like a maniac. I think I've put in something like, 12, 13 hours of meerkatting since yesterday's show. And I'm even streaming right now, sitting right there at the end of the table while doing the show for a behind-the-scenes look. First, follow me on Twitter at Mike Elgin, and then use the app to follow me on Meerkat. I think if you follow me on Twitter, you'll automatically see me on Meerkat in the app. So check that out. So let us know what you think. Send us an email to tnt@twit.tv or call us at 260-TNT-SHOW and leave a message. Don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. My name is Mike Elgin. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.